parallel with this internal recovery of France is a kind of external recovery. That is to say that there are, where the French spent the 14th and the 15th centuries fighting with the English inside of France, after the mid-15th century, they start going abroad. And they engage in wars of conquest against the Spanish in southeastern France, against the Burgundians in eastern France, and, as I mentioned earlier, into Italy from 1494 forward. Well, if the first point, therefore, is this overwhelming French strength, the second point we need to make about the Habsburg-Valois struggle is that the reality of this threat, the threat of France, prompts the creation of a kind of counter-system by the Habsburg house. It's based on diplomacy, and it's based on strategic marriage, and it ends up creating a kind of super-empire in Europe, which at its height includes not only Spain, most of Italy, the Netherlands, the Holy Roman Empire, but also parts of Hungary, almost all of Latin America, in the Philippines as well. It's one of the first world empires in human history. Now, the fact that it's spread all over the globe means that it's unwieldy. It is hampered by commitments all over Europe. But it is nonetheless a formidable and quite effective rival to French imperialistic ambitions. And the ultimate outcome of the Habsburg-Valois struggle between 1494 and 1559 is that the French don't have very much to show for all of their fighting. Which brings us to the third point. What happens when the French are not successful? Their lack of success in Italy prompts the French monarchs to look for allies beyond the pale. That is to say, they start opening up alliances with heretics and heathens. Or, to put it in more accurate terms, the French crown begins opening up alliances with German Protestants from the 1530s, and even with the Muslim Ottoman Turks from the 1530s as well. It is true that there is a medieval tradition of French alliances with Rhineland princes in order to make life difficult for the German emperors. The point that's worth stressing here is that when these Rhineland princes became heretics, even according to the official ideology of France, it didn't disrupt the alliances between the French crown and the German princes. This was embarrassing in the sense that it made the French crown's commitment to Catholicism look a little bad, but it was also very useful. And as we shall see again in later lectures, France in the early modern period was always willing to ally with whomsoever it wanted if it added political advantage. Having talked so much about war leads us to the fourth point, which is that war is what early modern kings do. It's not very edifying. Nowadays, states have all kinds of social welfare and educational functions. But in the early modern period, aside from passing justice and reviewing some kinds of legal things, the basic thing that kings do, at least the thing that they enjoy most, is fighting. The ideal of a king is the warrior prince. Even the status of noble, for that matter, is grounded in the bearing of arms. Kings seem to have viewed the world around them almost as a great big tournament. Princes fought with their rivals for personal honor, to gain glory, and that's what they were happiest doing. Nevertheless, and this is the fifth point, for all the enthusiasm that early modern monarchs had for warfare, the basic reality was that war was exceedingly expensive. Over the course of the 16th century, we'll see an increasing proportion of the fighting being done by professional mercenaries rather than by people raised by feudal levy. And the expenses of war tended to absorb almost all of the revenues of the crowns, of all crowns. In fact, especially after the 1530s, what we'll find, ironically, is that the pace of warfare is as much dictated by the state of the treasury as it is by the outcome of the battlefield, and monarchs are often stopped from fighting less by being defeated on the battlefield than by having no money left in the treasury with which to buy soldiers. Indeed, if we look at the Habsburg-Valois struggle in the early 16th century, imminent bankruptcy brought ends of wars in 1538, in 1546, in 1556, and again in 1559. The last point I'd like to make about warfare in this period is that the projection of power, as might now must seem obvious, was really very difficult. There was a very strong tendency for these wars to stalemate. The classic pattern in the Habsburg-Valois struggle was a series of early French successes which could not be sustained. Neither crown was really able to mount an effective invasion of each other's home territories. These campaigns tended to get bogged down in sieges, which were debilitating, they were expensive, they rarely yielded decisive results, and the problem of sustaining armies in the field was never really properly solved. Again, you have to keep in mind that an early modern army of 10,000 people, which is actually small by the 17th century standards, 10,000 soldiers moving around the countryside is akin to moving, by early modern standards, a small-sized city around the countryside and keeping it fed and supplied and sheltered and so on and so forth. And so that even decisive battles, for example, did not lead to dramatic gains at the peace settlement. It was often a stalemate and often ended by bankruptcy.